I'm glad that you're here this evening. This less than the second half, I think, of a sermon that Brother Roberts preached two Sundays ago. You remember perhaps that he used the text two Sundays ago from Philippians chapter 1 and verse 21, in which the Apostle Paul makes the rather amazing statement to those who are of the world. Certainly it's an amazing statement. Philippians 1 and verse 21, he says, "For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." And Brother Roberts, a couple of weeks ago, spoke most eloquently about the estimate of life that is involved in what Paul says when he says, "For me to live is Christ," and brought home to us the point that our role here is to glorify God and to serve others, and that the Apostle Paul had so fully absorbed those values that he could say his whole life was focused on, and the substance and the essence of his life was Christ himself. And of course, it is only in that context that he is then able to go ahead and say the second half of that statement, to claim that to die is gain. I mean, that is an amazing statement that he makes about that. There are some people, of course, who in this world would say to die is gain because they are enduring such terrible torment or suffering, some disease that has working its way through their body and causing them pain, so much so that they desire release from that and would say to die is gain. In fact, we even have a kind of a modern sort of discussion, I guess, about an old issue, and that is whether or not people have the right or should have the legal right to take their own life. And we have this Dr. Kevorkian, Dr. Death, who seems to have taken the lead, or at least has become an icon of that in our society, that people ought to have the right to choose to release themselves from the pain of some terminal disease in this life. There are people, you see, who might think of death as gain from that point of view. That clearly is not what the Apostle Paul has in mind. His statement, to die as gain, is not in some way a denial of life. It is an affirmation of something that is greater than life. And it is not a cry of despair. It is in some ways an anticipation of victory. For he can say that in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 6, where he faces, I think, again, and maybe with even more certainty than he did when he wrote the letter to the Philippians, death. And in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 6, with death staring him in the face, or rather he staring death in the face, he says in 2 Timothy 4 and verse 6, "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith, and finally there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but to all who have loved his appearing." And it is indeed a victory shout in which the Apostle Paul says, that crown is now within my grasp. It is something that I have looked forward to, I have worked toward, I have reached out for, I have yearned for, and now it is just imminent that I am going to receive that reward. He speaks of his death as a departure, as an exodus. It is, in fact, the same word that Jesus had used when he spoke about his exodus or his departure that he was to accomplish when he talked with Moses and Elijah on the Mount of Transfiguration. It is a recognition and affirmation that death is not an end, but a beginning. It is a new beginning. It is a new phase and a better phase of the life of those who have a right relationship with God. But we have to admit it is hard to view life in that way when we are actually facing it. It is hard to view death in that way when we are facing death ourselves, or when we see death in the face of those that we love. The secret, of course, is how we have lived our life, as Brother Roberts pointed out to us 2 weeks ago. "For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." The second half of that statement makes no sense without the first half. I mean, you try that out in terms of what other people think of as the focus of their life. "For me to live is making money, to die is," well, certainly not gain, but loss. "For me to live is pleasure, to die is loss. For me to live is fame, to die Well, it might be possible, you see, for somebody to accomplish a certain notoriety or fame by their death. But if they're dead, they have no recognition of that. For me to die, if life is fame, for me to die, death is not gain, but loss. The only way that statement makes any sense is as the Apostle Paul has it. For me to live is Christ, and then for me to die is indeed gain. Without Christ, without that information which he brings to us and that hope which he infuses in us, then death is indeed the enemy. People who are without Christ fear death. Most of us, imbibing as we do of the values of the people in the world abound about us, don't even like to talk about death. We don't like to face death. We do so perhaps with a joke or a chuckle to cover up our own sense of uneasiness about that. But death is something that we try and put out of our minds. It's something we try and put out of our sight. It's an amazing thing, really, I guess a unique period in human history that we live in which death is so cleverly and thoroughly exercised from our lives. People go to the hospitals to die, so we only have to see them a little bit. We don't keep them there in our homes and watch the disease wasting them away. We bring other people into our homes to watch them die, so we don't have to do that. And when they're dead, we send them to some mortuary somewhere for them to take care of the body, and we only go in mass to see them with other living people, and mostly we spend our time talking to the living rather than recognizing that we're in the presence of death. I mean, it used to be just my dad's generation that the dead were kept there in the house. And people would take their turns through the nighttime vigil, sitting in the room with the dead. We would have a hard time with that, sitting quietly at night, everyone else asleep, no one else perhaps in the room except you and the dead person, maybe that you love, maybe that you didn't know so very well. We try and hide it from ourselves, and we do a great job of hiding it from ourselves, but we can only hide it for so long, and we certainly cannot avoid it, for no one escapes death. And those who are without the Lord certainly have a different attitude about death than those who have lived for Christ. In fact, if we understand anything at all about the life after this without Christ, it is a fearsome prospect. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 7, the Apostle Paul reminds those Christians in Thessalonica that they have a different attitude about death and the end of life than those who are without Christ. 2 Thessalonians 1 and verse 7, he says, "And to give you who are troubled rest with us when the Lord Jesus is revealed from heaven with his mighty angels." Rest for you, but he's going to be revealed in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who do not know God and those who do not know the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. And these shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power when he comes in that day to be glorified in his saints and to be admired among all those who believe. Indeed, there is that kind of, again, clear division the Bible presents to us. Two groups, those who admire the Lord and are thankful for his coming, and those who, because they have not lived for Christ, must feel the dread of his vengeance when he has come in his glory. And those who have not lived for Christ are kept because of their fear of death in some kind of pitiful sort of slavery. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 15 talks about those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. And indeed, to be in fear of death is to be in a bondage, a slavery of some sort, a pathetic sort of slavery in which there is not even any return on the effort of the slaves. You just think about, probably illustrated pretty well in our current circumstances, those people who, because of the threat of terrorism and took that seriously and went about and maybe even are still going about in fear of their lives, who went out and bought gas masks and worried about how they were going to seal up their homes, and who took their mail trembling in their gloved hands and would take it to some sealed plexiglass box to open it undercover lest they would get anthrax spores, and how pathetic a slavery, a bondage that is to be constantly in fear for your life. And certainly we take due prudence about realistic threats. But it is a terrible thing to see people whose whole life is distorted because of their fear of death, their fear of germs so that they can't go outside, or their fear of risk so that they can't enjoy any of the activities of life that other people just take for granted. But Jesus has released us from that bondage, that slavery, by freeing us of sin and its consequences. Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 and 15 really talks about the freedom rather than about the bondage of the fear of death. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14, "Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death," that is the devil, "and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage." It is, in fact, because of Jesus, as we have every reason to know, those of us who are called by his name are Christians, disciples. We have every reason to know that there is victory in Jesus Christ, a victory that supersedes any fear we might once have had of death. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the Apostle Paul really is making an argument here about the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, but the implication of that is to recognize our own resurrection from the dead and the victory that we have over death and over sin, which is the power of death. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 54, "So when this corruptible has put on incorruptibility, and this mortal has put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass that which is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your sting? O Hades, where is your victory? The sting of death is sin. The strength of sin is in the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ." There is, in fact, every reason for those of us who understand Jesus' work in freeing us of sin and freeing us of the consequences of sin, there is every reason for us to be able to say, as the Apostle Paul did, that death is gain. We are hard-pressed, however, to say that death is gain and not to think of it as loss when we look at the cold, dead pallor of those that we have loved who have been laid aside because of death. To think about the stillness of death, the sound of their voice that will never ring again. To think about the futility even of the embalmer's art in which we try desperately to preserve, to put off for one little moment of time the decay of the body that inevitably is going to happen. And to think about our own loss when we think about our death, to think about the fact that we will never again be able to speak to our children. We'll not have the opportunity one more time to try and convince our spouse that we love them. We will never hear again those things that give us pleasure, whether it is the singing of the congregation together or the sound of the voice of those that we love. We will never know again the warmth of hospitality or the gratitude of giving a gift or the warm feeling that comes from having given a gift. And yet, if we look by the eyes of faith, I think that we may see, as the Apostle Paul knew by his faith in Jesus Christ, that to die is gain. What do we see the dead as having lost? Or what do we see ourselves as having lost if we were to die? Is it treasure that we shall lose? And some people have made it their life to amass great treasure. Luke chapter 12, we're told about the rich fool who has spent his whole life piling up treasure and has built bigger storehouses so he may store the grain, which was the form of treasure in those days. Shall we miss after we die the accumulation of our 403B? Shall we miss the gathering together of treasures and antiquities in our homes, the paintings on the wall? Shall we miss those things? Matthew chapter 6 and verse 20, the Lord himself said that we are not to lay up for ourselves treasures on earth where the moth may corrupt and the rust may corrupt and thieves may break in and steal, but we are to lay up for ourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. There's a treasure in heaven that goes far beyond any sort of treasure that we may lay up for ourselves here below. Is it, in fact, loss when we die and leave those things to someone else? No, to die is gain from that point of view. Is it our house that we worry about that we're going to miss when we're gone? And surely we've invested so much time in our homes. Made it look the way we want it to look, perhaps. We have labored in a labor of love over it. Well, sometimes not so much labor of love over it. And I don't know about that. Every time I think about that, I think more about the effort. Because, you know, I used as an illustration for 10 years about the house we had on Glen Ridge Avenue, about the rotting fascia boards. And about, you know, every time I walked up to the house, I felt that sense of guilt because they were rotting a little more and I needed to fix them. Well, finally I had to fix them when we sold the house. So now we're in this new house, and guess what? Rotting fascia boards. Yes. No loss, because think of what we have when we get in heaven. John chapter 14, verses 1 and 2. Jesus said to the disciples who were worried about him going away in John 14, verse 1, "Let not your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you." One of the songs that we might have sung this evening along this line is 393. And wonderful song suggests to us, "I'm satisfied with just a cottage here below, a little silver and a little gold. But in that city where the ransom will shine, I want a gold one that's silver lined. I've got a mansion just over the hilltop. I've got a mansion waiting for me." The house that we have here, is that lost when we die? No, to die is gain. What about the body that we live in and that we are so fond of? Used to might be a better way to say it. Maybe we're not as fond of our bodies as we want. Everybody's unhappy with their body, you know. I talked to the barbers about that. People that got curly hair, they want straight hair. People that got straight hair, they want curly hair. Everybody's unhappy with their hair. Everybody's unhappy with some aspect of their body. They're too fat. They're too skinny. They're too tall. They're too short. They're too stubby of fingers. Their fingers are too long. But when you start thinking about it, most people say, "Oh, it would be a terrible thing to miss out on this body that I'm used to. You know, I've grown accustomed to your face. Every morning I look at it in the mirror." But think about what happens when we die. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 35, Paul was talking about the resurrection, and he says in anticipation, he says, someone will say, "How did the dead raise up? Well, what kind of body do they come?" 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 42, he says, that's the resurrection of the dead. The body is sown in corruption. It is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. And I don't understand all the details of all of that, but I do understand the main point that he's making here, and that is to die is gain. The body that we have here, no matter how much we become accustomed to it, no matter how much we might like it, no matter how much we think we might miss it, it is gain to leave this one behind and to get the body in which we will be raised. Some people are worried about the clothes, perhaps, that they are going to leave behind. Closets full of clothes, and indeed the clothes do sometimes make the man. But you understand, no matter how many nice clothes you have, no matter how many pairs of shoes you have, that the styles are going to change in 5 minutes, and that they're going to be out of style. And you understand, too, that if you find one that just really is nice and you like it, before you know it, you've worn it and worn it out, and it isn't so nice anymore, and you don't know that, and then somebody will say, you know, you've got a thread loose on your shirt, and they pull it, and you know, there's a big gaping hole, and you think, I just bought this shirt. I love this shirt. Is it loss for us to leave those things behind? Well, no, it is gain to die and leave those things behind. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 5, he who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments. Revelation 6 and verse 11, then in a white robe given to each of them. And when the Lord provides us with white robes and white clothing, it is better than any clothing that we shall have ever here on this earth. To die is gain. Shall we think about other more positive kinds of things, perhaps? The singing that we love so much. And there are people who experience greater throes of ecstasy in listening to the singing of the congregations than I do. Some people just love that. And is that going to be a loss that we're not going to have that? No. You understand in Revelation 14 and verse 3 that they sang a new song before the throne. And we could look at the song here. I want to hear that mighty chorus roll. The singing that we enjoy so much here is as nothing compared to the singing that we will hear in heaven when the angels sing and the redeemed sing together. That which we think of as singing here and enjoy so much will pale into insignificance in comparison to that which we will hear in heaven. To die is gain from that point of view. And do we think somehow about the privilege that we have of reading the Bible and learning about God and knowing these things? 1 Corinthians chapter 13 reminds us, verses 12 and verse 13, that now we see in a mirror dimly, then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I am known. We shall know more and more thoroughly then than we do now. To die is gain. And we think about the friends that we may leave behind, that we will not again be able to speak to those that we love here below. And yet, we have, sometimes some of us have more friends in heaven than we have here. Depends on how far along the road you are of life, as to whether your friends have gone on ahead of you or not. And whether we think about the matter of how many friends that we have here that have been already departed and gone ahead, or whether we're going ahead of them and they will be coming later, I'll tell you this, we have better friends in heaven than ever we have had here below, no matter how much we may have a friend who sticks to us closer than a brother. And if you have friend or friends such as that, then count your blessings while you're here and treat them as you ought. But we have better friends in heaven. For when we get to heaven, we shall be there with Jesus and with the Lord, who has been the best friend that we've ever had, who has served us even when we were unworthy of the kind of service that he provided for us, and who will meet us and welcome us with open arms. To die is gain. And death is gain too. When you think about what we leave behind when we make that exodus from this life into life to come. Revelation chapter 7 and verse 17 reminds us that God will wipe away every tear from their eye. Revelation 21 and verse 4, God will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. To have left behind pain and sorrow and tears and loss that are part of this life means to die is gain. And perhaps most importantly, we leave behind, when we leave this life, we leave behind sin. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 2, Beloved, now we're children of God, not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And everyone who has this hope in himself purifies himself just as he is pure. There's the possibility. There is the certainty that if we are faithful to the Lord here, and if he is faithful to his promises, about which there is no doubt, that we shall be taken into heaven and transformed into that which we so yearn to be here. We want to be better than we are. We try to be better. We try and put these sins out of our lives. But like the Apostle Paul reveals his own very personal experience in Romans chapter 7, the good that I strive to do, I do not do, and the evil that I strive not to do, the very thing that I do. But there will come a day, only after we've made the exodus and the departure from this life, there will come the day when we'll leave behind that sin and we'll be made perfect in heaven. There will be no sin there. And death is gain. Death is gain not only because of the things we leave behind, but it is gain because of what is there that is not here. Oh, in a way, God is here. He has promised to be with us even in this very assembly where two or three are gathered together. The Apostle Paul understood, however, that there was a sense in which death would put him more immediately, more directly into the presence of God. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 23, he said, I am hard pressed between the two, that is, to live or to die, having a desire to depart and to be with Christ, which is far better. Oh, yes, the Lord was with him. The Lord was with him on the road to Damascus in a very special way. The Lord was with him in those trials and spoke to him as he is with us every day. But there's a special way in which the Lord will be with us, or rather we will be with the Lord when we've made our departure from this life, a way in which we cannot really, probably even fully appreciate until we have seen the glory of God in heaven. Revelation chapter 4, we're privileged to see, as John was privileged to see in that vision, the throne room of God. Revelation chapter 4, after these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven, and the first voice which I had heard like the sound of a trumpet speaking with me said, "Come up here, and I will show you what makes take place after these things." And immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne was standing in heaven, and one sitting on the throne. And he who was sitting was like a jasper stone, and a sardis in appearance. And there was a rainbow around the throne, like an emerald in appearance. And John is struggling here with the eyes of flesh that are trying to see this vision of wonder in heaven, and struggling with the inarticulateness that is ours, with the inability of human language to describe what there is in heaven. One like a jasper stone, like a sardis, like an emerald, a rainbow like an emerald around him. To understand that, we'll have to be there to see it. You know, we say that sometimes. You got to see it to believe it. Or you say, you got to see it for yourself. And this is certainly true about the presence of God in His throne room in heaven. To die is gain, for we shall see Him just as He is. It is best that we should die. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 1, a good name is better than precious ornament. The day of death is better than the day of one's birth. It is hard for us to see that. Insofar as we do not live for Christ, it is hard for us to see that. And there are many adventures that are part of our life here, but there is nothing that compares to the adventure of heaven. There is nothing that compares to the fulfillment of being with God and Jesus Christ in heaven. It is the best thing for us. Even the ancients in some ways struggled with that idea. Trophimus, who was supposed to have built the Delphus shrine to Apollo, after he had finished and dedicated it, asked as a gift that he should have the best that was possible for man. And the oracle told him, go home and in 3 days you shall have it. And in 3 days he was dead. And that's, a dim inkling from heathen minds somehow of the great truth that has been revealed to us in Jesus Christ. That the best for us is not in this life, but it is in the life to come. For me to die is gain. There's an old saying among some of the early Christians. It is not a death, but life which joins the dying man to Christ. And that is not a life, but death which separates a living man from Christ. To be separated from Christ here in this life, that's really death. But to die, as the Apostle Paul says, and to be with the Lord, that is gain indeed, because it is a cure. It is a cure for our sin and a cure for our imperfections. I tell the story about a lame man and a blind man who are being burned at the stake. And as they're chained there, the lame man throws his crutches over into the flame, and he tells the blind man, "Be of good cheer, for today we shall be cured." Cured indeed of whatever kind of physical imperfections we may have, but more importantly, cured indeed of whatever kind of spiritual imperfections we may have. Death is not the death of the man, but the death of his sin. And death will work such a cure in us as will be beyond all believing on this side of it. The Apostle Paul understood that when he said, "For me to live is Christ, to die is gain." And it is, in some ways, a perfect rest. There is no perfect rest here. There are occasions when we approach that, when we have been diligent and we've done what we were supposed to do, and we have labored both mentally and physically, and we are tired and exhausted with that good kind of tiredness and exhaustion that comes from having done something worthwhile. And when we lie down and we take our rest, and we enjoy it. But for the most part, we don't have rest like that. For the most part, it's interrupted because we know we didn't really quite do the job as well as we ought to have done it. It's interrupted because the aches and the pains of the body that we have here just won't let us rest as we ought to have rested. But there is a perfect rest. Job chapter 3 and verse 17, Job, with only a very dim understanding, said, "There the weary are at rest," speaking of the grave. Little did he understand the full import of that as revealed to us in Jesus Christ, that there is perfect rest because of the work that he did for us. Matthew chapter 11 and verse 28, perhaps that's what he had in mind when he said, "Come to me, all you who labor and are weary laden, and I will give you rest." Rest ultimately in God, in heaven. To die is gain. But only if we have said, as the Apostle Paul could say, "For me to live is Christ." Is death gain to you? I know that it is, and if not, you need to make yourself right with the Lord Jesus Christ this very evening, and we sing this song to encourage you to do so.